The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined today by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. And we actually sat in the Spectator garden at a safe distance, according to government guidelines, for our first podcast back as a group. So to begin with, James, it's not just us who are returning. We also have MPs back in Parliament today. What's the mood? Because we're also today seeing the government and the Speaker's plans for a new way of voting. And I think from just walking around Parliament earlier, it's quite clear this has not landed so well with opposition MPs or quite a few Tory MPs.
Yes, I mean, there is a problem with this. There is a feeling that the current idea of a kind of long conga-style line of MPs to vote isn't really practicable. Now, there are a series of issues with it. One is the obvious question that this makes no accounting for those MPs who shouldn't be in today because of their health conditions. Some of them had a very difficult decision to make about whether they choose to stay at home or whether they come in to represent their constituents. The second slightly more mundane complaint is, I think lots of MPs just think this is going to take a long time and make them all look slightly ridiculous. And the third argument you hear is, I think a lot of people support Jacob Rees-Mogg's desire to get Parliament back up and running, to send a signal to the country that it's time to get back to work. Now, that noise out there, my idea was it was so quiet earlier on, despite the fact the Spectator Garden backs onto a main road, that we could record the podcast out here to show how quiet central London is. But there's a bit more traffic there than I had been anticipating. But no, but I think there is a view that, you know, it's important that Parliament gets back. But what was meant to demonstrate that it's time to get back to work, as one senior Tory MP said to me this morning, is actually turning into a story of how difficult it is to get a workplace back up and running. And that is the opposite of the message that this move was intended to send out.
Fraser, Jacob Rees-Mogg has written explaining why he thinks it's so important to get MPs back in Parliament and voting in person. There's also a sense in government too, perhaps not felt as strongly as by the Leader of the House, that you need to set an example that if you keep virtual voting in place, you potentially get to a point where you have given away in the argument of whether or not MPs have to be in Westminster to do their job. So do you see a merit in the current idea of a kilometre-long conga, socially distanced line running through the Houses of Parliament?
To be honest, I started my job as a political reporter in the Scottish Parliament, where they do electronic voting. It is not beyond the wit of man to press a button in a legislature nowadays. I know that goes against the usual vibe of Westminster, but I don't see why it has to be either having a dismembered parliament scattered across the country or doing the conga in the yard of the Palace of Westminster. You'd think modern technology would allow there to be other means of doing this. I know that, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg is a traditionalist. If he had his way, they'd probably all still be wearing wigs and saying prayers before sitting. But you'd think there would be something. WhatsApp, I don't know. I mean, there must be some technology. But hopefully this will be a short-lived problem, because all the time you can see that cities, parliaments, places are opening up world over. There is not a resurgence of the virus anywhere. And I think the experiment of lockdown, I think, is beginning to end.
Speaking of a resurgence of coronavirus, James, today we've heard from Neil Ferguson, formerly the government advisor who stepped aside from that official role when it emerged that he had a friend, we'll say, visit him in his private residence. Since then, he's clearly still doing work on this, and he's been speaking to MPs today, and he suggested that even if we don't see a rise in or significant rise in coronavirus infections in the coming weeks, if not months, the real danger point is actually September. Do you think that's a view shared in government, that actually the autumn is really when it's going to get difficult again?
Yes, the worry about, I mean, people's views on this virus keep changing. At first, people thought it would be seasonal, but then people thought it wouldn't be seasonal. Now people seem to think it'll be seasonal again. And one of the worries is, how would the NHS cope with both the winter flu season and a second wave of coronavirus? And I think that part of the reason the government is so keen to crack on with getting things back open again is if, for example, you haven't opened up the hospitality sector this summer, not only is that going to send lots of businesses to the wall because they basically lose money in the winter, make money in the summer, but it's also going to be a problem because you don't want to open up pubs, for example, in September or October, because if that does cause a second spike, that could create a real problem for the health service. So I think there is a kind of sense of seasonality right now. But as Fraser said, the thing which the government, I think the government has been surprised by, is how little reaction there has been in those European countries where they've begun to ease up the restrictions. Now, those cabinet ministers who still want to go slowly, slowly say, look, these are real baby steps. This is, people talk about Italy, it's restaurant tables outside, right? It's not full normal life. But there does seem to be a fact that none of these European countries have seen a second wave following their decisions to ease up on restrictions.
It's not just European countries. Several states in America have eased up as well. And there was a fascinating note by JP Morgan a few days ago pointing out that not only has the virus failed to revive itself in states that have eased lockdown, it's actually fallen. JP Morgan's conclusion was that there isn't actually a link between the spread of the virus and the state's decision to lock down. We've just had a select committee hearing this morning where they referenced the work of one scientist who calculates that lockdown hasn't saved a single life in any European country. Now, that is at one extreme of the analysis. At the other extreme, we have the Imperial College analysis, which said that lockdown would reduce deaths from a potential of 500,000 in Britain to 5,700. So in other words, it credits lockdown as being the biggest factor in something like a 99% reduction in the mortality rate. We know from Britain the other truth here, that we didn't have deaths of 5,700. We didn't have deaths limited at 20,000, which is the claim that Neil Ferguson said would happen after we locked down. We've had data today from the ONS that looks as if the figure here is going to be closer to 50,000. This is a shocking, absolutely shocking figure. And it does raise another question about lockdown. What did it achieve? Neil Ferguson himself was giving evidence to the committee this morning, and he pointed out that actually Brits have observed lockdown more faithfully than their models suggested. So you have to ask what went wrong. If it wasn't the behaviour of the country, if people did all that was asked of them by the government and more, there must have been a mistake in the assumptions behind lockdown. Now, I think this matters not so much to get into a blame game, of which I've got personally not very much interest at all. I think all the scientists were making their best guesses at the start of this. They had no choice. I think Imperial College's model, which has come up for a lot of flack, it was a perfectly coherent model. It was just using assumptions that were guessed. But if there is going to be a second wave of this, how Britain responds will be crucial, and how Britain responds ought to be informed by what worked this time around. And what strikes me listening to the British debate is how, and also listening to the Select Committee hearing this morning, is how little we seem to know about what works and what doesn't. We're still almost as much at a loss to understand this as we were when the virus emerged in the first place. We know a lot more about the virus. We know that 4 out of 5 people who've got it in Britain, according to the last figures, don't even know they've got it because they're asymptomatic. But we don't know what sort of measures tame it and which encourage it. And it doesn't seem as if our experience or that of the rest of Europe has left anybody much the wiser.
James, we are currently in some form of lockdown in the sense that we've only begun easing it. But just, I suppose, thinking long term, Fraser says we haven't learnt so much in terms of how to live with this virus. If we look at the autumn, we look at the winter, you mentioned the idea of opening pubs in September isn't seen as particularly wise. We also had the Chancellor on Friday saying the furlough scheme will be wound down, you know, it will end in October. So do you think we're potentially heading to a situation where it is wound down but suddenly has to be brought back up pretty sharpish because we are back in an autumn-winter lockdown?
No, because the government's great hope is that its test and trace system, which hopefully by then would have the app added to it, so test, track and trace and all that. That will enable it to follow this kind of South Korean style model where you don't have to go for the sledgehammer option of a national lockdown. You can lock down locally to deal with outbreaks. I also think, let's be realistic here, the economic cost of a lockdown to all of the countries that have experienced it means I will be very surprised if this autumn and winter we end up with lockdowns in any European country. Because I just think the cost has been so great in terms of the economics that few governments will want to go back to that a second time. And so I think that, I mean, I think the UK government's hope is that it will be able to kind of deal targeted strikes on local outbreaks of infection. But I think a kind of second national lockdown would be such an economic and political disaster that the bar to that is exceptionally high.
And Fraser, we're in a very quiet St. James Park today, technically in the garden, but you get the gist of what I mean. And there aren't that many people around. Ultimately, that's in part because lockdown hasn't been relaxed as much as we expect it to be in the coming weeks and months. But is part of the issue that even if the government does relax lockdown measures, people might decide they'd rather stay in because they're still very worried about this, because the polling repeatedly seems to suggest that.
Yeah, people in this country are very fearful, and understandably so, because they were told for so many weeks that stepping outside risks basically killing somebody else, and that the virus was incredibly contagious. It will take a long time to undo the work that was done with the stay at home, save the NHS, save your family message that was so powerfully introduced by the government in the first time. And it's funny that when the government does ease it, I think it expects people to come rushing back to work. But I don't really think that's happening. I've just been amazed at how quiet the streets still are here in London. I mean, we are sitting here in the Spectator Garden having just finished chip suppers, which you, Kate, they kindly bought from our local chip shop, the Laughing Halibut. By the way, if any of our listeners are passing Westminster, we can heartily recommend this chip shop and the best fish and chips in Britain. But they were saying that things are still very quiet. Normally there's queues out of the door for that place, and quite right too. But even now that people can come back to work, they are still declining to do so. And I think it's going to be some time before the workforce really does return in full.
I mean, I mean, this is why psychologically the government have chosen to spend so much of our budget on easing up social restrictions. I mean, their hope is that people will see friends and family in the garden or the park and nothing bad will happen. And that will make people feel more confident about going outside and beginning this journey back to work. I was quite struck today. I walked from St. Paul's to Westminster about 9:45 or so. And it was very striking how I passed a lot of policemen and security guards, some construction workers, a huge number of joggers, vastly more than usual, but very, very few people going to work. It is striking how quiet it still is out there. Now, that's because lots of the offices that are in the city, you know, people have jobs that they can do from home. But, you know, there is a big question, I think, for the government. But as you said, Katie, the polls still show that half the public think the lockdown has been eased too quickly, which is, you know, how do you begin to induce confidence and get people back to work? Look at the fact that when schools have reopened and the initial signs are that about 60% of parents haven't chosen to send their children into school. And that is going to be one of the big challenges for government. Does it start to reopen the economy and society and find that nobody wants to come out?
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.